KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Director Shaunak Sen is Oscar-nominated for All That Breathes, his film about two brothers who run a bird hospital in India. He says it's hard enough to get financing for documentary films, but keeping creative control is even harder.
Money is almost never without a caveat, especially for an early career filmmaker. It's super important, at least for me at any rate, is to hold on to creative sovereignty. And therefore, you have to listen to the smaller, tiny voices in your head, which gets difficult if you don't have contractual autonomy.
Shaunak Sen talks about how a simple Google search led him to the brothers in his film and explains why he scrapped 8 months' worth of footage midway through the shoot. The work paid off. His film won big at Sundance and Cannes. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, as you have reported in a very interesting piece for Puck, there is a big question about the big TV hit Yellowstone, which is in limbo right now because Kevin Costner, who is a little bit important to that show, is doing what stars sometimes do. And Kevin Costner is, you know, more than a star. He's an Oscar-winning director. But Kevin Costner, whose career as an actor had been a little sleepy before the show brought him back. And, you know, who knows how he felt about that, but it appears that he is feeling that maybe he doesn't want to be doing all the Yellowstone stuff anymore.
Well, there's certainly a standoff right now. The show is in limbo because Costner has decided that he would like to direct the second of two Western films that he is very passionate about this summer. And he's only providing a small window of availability to come back to shoot Yellowstone. And there are various reasons why that show has been delayed and is not on the schedule that he originally thought it was going to be on. But it gets to the point now where there is such animosity between Kevin Costner's team and the producers that they are ready to move on and finish up this version of Yellowstone this season with or without him, and then do another version, potentially with Matthew McConaughey, that would start after this season of Yellowstone. And that's a real risk because we're talking about the number one show in television right now. More people watch Yellowstone on linear TV than any other show. And it has spawned a litany of spinoffs that are incredibly important to the Paramount streaming service, Paramount Plus. So if you take that anchor out of the Yellowstone franchise, the anchor being Costner, the question is, does the rest of this endeavor suffer?
Well, they have launched shows without him, so they're not as big, but they exist. I think Taylor Sheridan, you know, who is the fountain of all of these things and who seems to be an inexhaustible source of material, just one thing after another after another, we have reason to believe he's not the easiest guy in the world either. Definitely not. And Kevin Costner also maybe not the easiest guy. So this may be an example of two strong-willed people who are not going to be able to come to terms.
No, and that is probably the likely scenario here. And I have been told that Sharon is pretty upset right now because he's in this limbo where he can't write the final episodes of this season 5 of Yellowstone without knowing whether the star of the show is going to be in them or not. And that's a really weird place to be. But you could make a strong argument that the Yellowstone franchise has outgrown Kevin Costner. It is so big now, and they've launched 1883 and 1923 with Helen Mirren and Harrison Ford, and they've got prequels that are planned every 20 years leading up to the present time, and they've got other spinoffs and huge stars that Sheridan is working with, like Stallone, and he's got, you know, a Nicole Kidman show and a bunch of other things in this so-called Sheridan universe that they don't need Kevin Costner. And if they can put a bunch of the core Yellowstone cast onto a new show with someone like Matthew McConaughey, that would not only be a way to revitalize the show, but it would get them out of this very onerous Peacock deal. And because if you remember, the digital rights to Yellowstone in the U.S. were sold to Peacock, the NBC Universal streamer, not to Paramount Plus. So the sequels and all of the spinoffs are on Paramount Plus, but the original show is on Peacock, and Paramount would very much like to remedy that situation.
I'm sure they would. I'm holding out for the Stone Ages edition, you know, where they really go back.
The cavemen of the Dutton family?
Yes, the cavemen of the Dutton family. You could get some guys in some loincloths and who knows what might happen. I will note that Kevin Costner is among the highest paid stars on television. He's also done a lot of investing and he owns a lot of real estate and he's wheeling and dealing. So he's not like holding a tin cup looking for more. He can afford to do without it. But most people like money when it's on offer.
Certainly, about $20 million a season. I mean, he's making $1.2 million per episode, according to my sources. And he additionally has an overall deal with the studio behind Yellowstone, which pays him more. And they were going to do 16 episodes this season. So if you do the math, that's about $20 million per season. And he was going to make more if they go to a season six. So this is a pretty lucrative show for him. And the sad thing is there was a path for him to kind of gracefully ease out. He wants to direct other movies. He's now got some cachet to do so. These movies, Horizon, which he's very passionate about and been developing a long time. He could have done those while also easing gracefully out of Yellowstone. But the animosity between him and the producers and the executives at Paramount and Taylor Sheridan, it's going to be a very difficult hurdle to overcome to get him back on that show at this point.
And as you say, it's not some kind of dignified, planned fade out. It's ugliness. And maybe that's just the way he rolls. I don't know. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. At just 24 years old, Indian filmmaker Shaunak Sen has already made two critically acclaimed feature-length documentaries. His most recent work, All That Breathes, won awards at both Sundance and Cannes, and it's now in contention for an Academy Award. Sen's debut film, the 2016 feature Cities of Sleep, explored the challenges that unsheltered people in Delhi face just in finding a safe place to bed down for the night. In Sen's latest film, All That Breathes, haunting shots of smog-filled landscapes reveal the ecological crisis in Delhi, where the air is so polluted that sometimes a black kite, a majestic bird of prey, simply falls from the sky. The film follows brothers Mohammed and Nadim, who run a bird clinic in their basement, where they've treated more than 20,000 birds. The kite is a traditional bird. Every life form adjusts to the city now. Rats, pigs, frogs, mosquitoes, turtles, insects, cows and horses. All improvise and adapt to the city. Congratulations on, you won a lot of awards and now you're nominated for Oscar. So that's, I imagine that's quite exciting.
You imagine correctly. It is, given how we started and where we began, this is a kind of galaxy that is entirely unfathomable, honestly, to us. And of course, it's difficult to wrap one's head around it. And we're obviously besides ourselves with relief and joy.
Yes, I should think so. And you can describe where you started. I know that you've talked about the derelict basement where you started filming. You're not gilding the lily, I should say, both in your depiction of Delhi and the circumstances where these brothers were working. I've never been to Delhi, but having seen your movie, I feel like I've had a visit there. You're not exactly doing this as a travel promotion. It's a very unsparing look at what is beautiful and what is not so beautiful.
Well, Delhi, like any of the major cities in the world, is an enormous place. So I don't know if my film should be the predominant sample size. It's definitely one pocket of the city. And of course, it does say something about the air that is pervasive. But having said that, it's like the city provides a lot to different people. I, however, was interested in particular in two things. I was interested in the air, or, you know, when you live in the city of Delhi, the air is a constant preoccupation. It takes on a kind of gray, opaque, almost creepy sentience like tone, and I was interested in that kind of a texture of life in the city, that all laminating grayness, and apart from that, I was interested in thinking of the city through the lens of non-human life. So it started as a kind of abstract triangulation between air, birds, and humans. That was vaguely the web of things that I was interested in. And I happened to just one day Google where do birds that fall off the sky go to. And that's when I came upon the work of the two brothers, Nadim and Saud. And it's what they do is singular and remarkable. From this tiny, like you correctly said, small, decaying, grubby basement, they...
I'm using your words. You described it as tiny, grubby, derelict basement. So,
well, it is entirely and utterly that. Those are the words that best describe that space.
Yeah, it's a small, grubby space, for sure. And let me just, you know, these guys are making soap dispensers, but meanwhile, they're just dealing with literally hundreds of birds.
Right, that's like their day job. But in the last 15 years, they've treated over 25,000 black kites. And they do it for the most part, often fairly unsupported and of their own volition. And I was very interested in why they do what they do. But to not make something that was like a conventional nature doc or a wildlife doc, not to make something that was, you know, just a sweet film about nice people doing good things, but a kind of ecological, emotional and socio-political history of the city and the state of affairs in Delhi, through the relationship of this one remarkable family and this one raptor, this one bird called the black kite.
Well, let me take it back a couple of steps. I mean, you talked about seeing these raptors, these kites, just fall out of the sky. It's something that, you know, people see regularly in Delhi?
No, that would be overstating it, certainly. Like, it's not like if you look up every now and then a bird pops down, that's not how it is. But, you know, it's a huge city. And if, say, 25 to 30 birds are getting injured and falling down, then, you know, it's not like people can regularly see it. In our 3 years, I've only seen it once in our 3 years of shooting. Having said that, the number is still staggering because the brothers get about, on some days, they get about 25 to 30 injured kites in one given day that have fallen down.
I did read that you had seen one of the birds fall and Googled it. But I also saw where you said that you had been reading a lot of literature about birds, the Peregrine by J.A. Baker, about this person who's following a peregrine falcon. And I think that also informed your feeling about making this film.
Indeed. Observing the birds only came in the wake of the great literature that I was often reading at the time. So essentially, I was in the UK for a fellowship at Cambridge, and I was basically housed in a department where a lot of people around me were working on human, non-human issues. So that was really the cloud of ideas, that is the broader conceptual force field around me. And I started reading a ton of books, you know, like Grief is a Thing with Feathers, H is for Hawk, The Peregrine, and a whole litany of excellent avian-related prose or fiction or nonfiction or poetry and so on. I wasn't a bird watcher prior to this. And then once I went to Delhi, I got more and more inspired by the figure of the black kite. And, you know, the picture postcard of Delhi is this dystopic gray monochromatic sky, especially in the winters, where you have these tiny black dots gliding in the sky. And these are the black kites that are lazily gliding often. And I was very fascinated by what one can do in terms of telling an ecological and a emotional and a sociopolitical story through the figure of the black kite.
Yes. So you're in this immersion with this literature. You see a bird fall, you look, and this is how you find these two brothers?
Well, I started researching on what happens to birds that fall off the sky. I basically wanted a kind of a moment of encounter between birds and humans. One way to go about it is the act of feeding, right? The other way is to look at this kind of slightly perverse moment where birds are falling off. And in this one claustrophobic tiny basement, these two brothers are like, you know, three tiny Don Quixotes just soldiering on. And to me, every single kite that flies off after getting injured from terrace enclosures is a bit of a micro miracle. And I was fascinated by their story, by what it allowed me to talk about in a more zoomed out, bigger sense, and also the sheer poetry of it.
It's clear from the film that money is a consideration for them. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you'd paid them, but for them, when you approached them, did they hesitate or did they immediately say, this can help us fund this work?
Well, it was both. Those are not obviously mutually exclusive binaries. So they were fairly media savvy in terms of giving quick media bites because within a very niche environmental circle, their work is known. So they have given like small bite-sized interviews in the past. That was actually a challenge for me because essentially what I had to do was to try and break them out of that because we don't use talking head as a format, right, in the film. This is a kind of creative doc which It's a verite observational doc where the main ambition is to get a sense of everyday, quotidian, banal, mundaneness, right? That's where characters are being instead of behaving in front of the camera. So there's a lot of conversation about where the film will go, how it can help. But of course, it's not like I had all the ready answers then. And very often a film is like a fever dream. You know, when you start, you sort of jump off a cliff and it's a bit of a free fall. And I tried to explain everything that I knew at the time. But I will also say that at that time, I didn't know where the film would land. And everything that has happened with the film was utterly and entirely outside of my orbit of predictive reasoning as well. How it began was, you know, you have to wait for a critical mass of boredom. Like you have to wait for characters to reach a point of boredom with the camera where it's not an obtrusive presence. I am not an obtrusive presence. And they're aware of me, but they're also, you know, not self-aware enough to change their behavior. So you essentially have to wait for the first yawn.
They become inured to the whole thing. They just carry on. Well, let me just take a step back there. So you had made this previous film about the battle for people who are not housed in India to find places to sleep, as I understand that. Am I right about that?
Yes, that was looking at the city through the lens of sleep. This one is looking at the city through the lens of non-human life, or more particularly, the bird life. So in a way, if the previous film was about the horizontal axis, this one sort of started emerging in my head through the vertical axis.
And when you want to do this, where do you go to finance it from the beginning?
Well, to a ton of places. So the thing is that, of course, it's not easy to fund a nonfiction film, especially because, you know, it takes really long. It took me 3 years to shoot and edit this film. So I, in the beginning, started by applying to grants, and we got grants from Sundance, IDFA, Tribeca, Catapult, and so on. I was fortunate enough to meet our producers, Teddy Leifer at Rice Films in the UK. And after that, you're basically a pitching machine. You know, you go through a bunch of doc incubation labs. There's one in Calcutta in India, and a ton of other documentary pitching forums, which are like meat markets where you meet different producers, sales agents, and any and all kinds of stakeholders, be it broadcasters, distributors, and so on. So you keep pitching the film and you essentially show at times a 3-minute pitch video, like a sizzle reel, or you show a longer kind of a 10 to 15 minute demo reel. In that, the hope is to meet the perfect match in terms of a financier or another studio. And we had the good fortune of then coming into contact with Tanglebank Studios, which is American film studio. And they were the ones who are the financiers of the film.
I read somewhere where you said you had learned the distinction between good money and bad money in terms of film financing.
Well, that's crucial, isn't it? You know, money is almost never without a caveat, especially for an early career filmmaker. It's super important, at least for me at any rate, is to hold on to autonomy and creative sovereignty. And especially if it's not a formulaic film that is easy to pitch, you know, because ultimately it's everybody's loss if the film does not come out as the best version of itself. And therefore, you have to listen to the smaller, tiny voices in your head, which gets difficult if you don't have contractual autonomy. You know, I was in this kind of a dreamy situation with excellent producers between Rice Films and Tanglebank Studios. So fortunately, we were able to hit a sweet spot.
Coming up after the break, Shaunak Sen talks about keeping his camera trained on his subjects in the midst of violent political protests in 2020. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. 8 months into production of his Academy Award-nominated documentary, All That Breathes, Delhi-based filmmaker Shaunak Sen scrapped all the footage he had shot and started over. Then COVID hit. Fighting through several starts and stops paid off in the end, with a premiere at Sundance, followed by a grand jury prize, and then a big win at Cannes. The documentary follows Nadeem and Mohammed, who run a bird clinic and rehabilitation center in their basement. Mohammed explains why he and his brother have been doing this work for the past 20 years. Our fights, don't think that they're because of petty financial reasons, or that it's an ego thing, or an emotional issue. The real reason's up here. What's happening with the birds? The air, the sky. Our fights are just a symptom of something much larger. I read that you dropped the first 8 months of your footage. Is that true? I mean, that almost made me feel pain physically.
It is, but and thank you for reading this comprehensively. But it sounds heroic and romantic in hindsight, but I had no other option then. When we started, I was shooting handheld. So all our material initially was in a more classic kind of a verite, handheld, observational, rough style. But I soon realized that when it's handheld camera, the tone is often a bit anxious or restless, you know, because the camera embodies in a felt and fleshy manner the camera person themselves. So if we had to essentially figure out a new tone, and I realized that the characters were themselves very contemplative and meditative folks, and the film had to have a form that allowed you to contemplate things and think about things, and it had to be beautiful. So we completely had to discard the handheld stuff because we moved into a more tripoded, flowy kind of a style. And there's no way one can use the rough, grimy handheld style and the smooth, aesthetic style. So we had to choose one or the other, which meant the hard decision of saying goodbye to two hard drives full of footage. But it had to be done.
And did the brothers turn to you and say, what? How much longer are you going to be here?
Well, the brothers would always be like, oh, how, and after a while, I feel like we became a wallpaper of their lives. You know, it's like they sort of took us as a kind of element in their lives that will be there for a long time. So it was often the case that we would, you know, it's like we shot for, and you, human beings also get very habituated to being witnessed, you know, and you become a part of, like, we were pretty much a part of their familial setup. So any kind of event or anything that is happening, they would themselves call and say, look, this is happening. Would you like to come? You know, mm-hmm. So the brothers were, I think, a bit surprised about how long it was taking, but they were very supportive. Also, more importantly, I think it was also an enjoyable process often, you know, we were also friends. So that was a good thing.
Now, the outside world, in terms of political reality or on the ground reality, it comes into the film, but indirectly. I'm not any expert on politics in India, but it seems very much that India is going through some challenging times, as we have been in this country in terms of politics. You're shooting during these Delhi riots of 2020, and that sort of seeps into the film, but you don't choose to explain what is going on. I mean, this has to do with the attitude of the Indian government towards Muslims, which the brothers are, but you sort of let it be in the film, but you don't go through any kind of explanation or discussion.
Well, the thing, when we began the film, it was meant to only and primarily be an ecological film and about the work of the brothers. But the thing is that the city of Delhi was obviously going through a very turbulent time, and there was a fair degree of social unease. And so much of it was happening right next to the brothers' house. But the brothers themselves are, you know, you have to trust the integrity of the lives that you're shooting. And the brothers are not very politically minded. I mean, they would say the stuff between humans and birds is as political also, which I think it is as well. But they're not conventionally political beings. And as such, I wanted to not, like, you know, it was tempting to point the camera streetwards, but I had to stick to the integrity of what I was shooting. Having said that, the outside world would often leak in small resonances, you know, in small murmurs of it. So a character goes to the balcony and you hear the audio of a crowd nearby, or a character is watching a video of clearly trouble in the city, and you only hear the audio of it. So I thought it would be best to very obliquely and tangentially, just like we witnessed it in their house. So we had to basically figure out a film grammar in which it was suggested that something else is going on, but not make it front and center.
The other thing that was happening while you were shooting was COVID, which, I mean, you glimpsed somebody in a mask at some point, but with the air quality, maybe you don't know quite what's going on, but you'd have to switch cinematographers. I don't know. COVID affected your production, right? I had to.
Profoundly. Also, I came down with a very bad case of it. It did affect us really badly because we had to have long stretches of time when we were not shooting. But what it also did, and like you correctly said, our German DP had to leave the country very urgently. One shoot schedule got disrupted midway. So it was very disruptive. But you also start, when you've receded into the inner confines of your house with nothing outside, life takes on a more somber, meditative quality generally. So I think it helped me ingest and marinate in footage. And personally speaking, the off time or the non-shooting time changed some of the tonal quality of the film, which is good.
Yes, I guess that's one good thing about that nightmare. So you go to Denmark to work with an editor at a certain point, Charlotte Munch Benson.
Yes, correct.
You've mentioned that she was a dancer and you felt that she was almost choreographing in the film.
Indeed, we were fortunate to, me and the co-editor Vedant Joshi, were fortunate to go to Copenhagen to cut with her. I was in awe of her work because I'd seen, you know, these monumental works like Act of Killing and Truffle Hunters and so on. And she has a completely different style or approach to material than I do. I tend to be very, perhaps too much, cerebral and interpretative and top heavy. Whereas she prescribes to what she calls an emotional edit. You know, she keeps, like, every time she would say, yes, but what does it feel like? Like, forget what you think of it. What does it feel like? And that's something that I really learned and imbibed via her. Because essentially, I tend to be like, okay, this shot after this shot after this shot means this. Whereas for her, it would often be like, forget what it means. Just tell me what it feels like. So it's a kind of stomach editing, you know, which I just hadn't ever experienced. And I think the film was infinitely richer because of this.
And you went to Cannes after Sundance. So you won a prize at Sundance and went to Cannes. And Cannes doesn't normally, I don't think they're so enthusiastic about documentaries usually.
Yes. I think we were very fortunate. And Cannes was kind enough to program us there because we did not have a physical premiere, right? Sundance was a virtual premiere. So in all senses, Cannes was the physical premiere of the film, which is obviously extraordinarily special. But that festival was interesting because you're slotted. It doesn't have an independent documentary section on its own. You're in the mix with fiction films. So it was a very unique and like personally for me, almost a euphoric experience to show there because a lot of my utter heroes were showing at the same time.
So now you've won these awards in Sundance and Cannes. You're nominated for BAFTA, DGA Award, an Academy Award. How is this changing your life? Is this going to make it easier to fund the next one? Are people already coming with bags of money, hoping for the next project?
The change is so monumental that I can't even tell how much the coordinates of my life have indeed shifted. I come from a world which is very, very far away from all of this, not just in terms of the glitz and the bells and whistle, but also in terms of pure visibility of the films I make. We did not get a big distributor for Cities of Sleep, my last film. So I don't take distribution as a given at all. So this, all of it feels almost unreal, to be honest. Many projects have been offered. I think people come with bags full of projects more than money.
More than money, right. So
exciting. But I think, I mean, what I need to do after the whole dizzying upheaval of the Oscar campaign gets done, I will unplug and go off somewhere remote for 2 to 3 months and slowly start excavating or mining ideas again and thinking about what I want to do next.
I imagine that you will need the rest too. Shaunak Sen produced and directed All That Breathes. The film is now streaming on HBO Max. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz and Ray Guarna, who also mixed the show. To hear more episodes of The Business, as well as other great KCRW entertainment podcasts, head to kcrw.com/FYC. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.